And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Anita from La Mesa.
Hi, everybody. My name's Anita. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Thank you, Randy, for inviting me. I stop around 9, Randy? 5 till, if I can go that long. So I want to thank my friends for coming out with me tonight. I asked a couple people to come. I haven't spoken from a large group in several months, and so it's always nice to have friendly faces in this crowd, you know. But after John and Bill and Jerry spoke, we could pretty much say the prayer and go home, you know. It's great, great 10-minute pitch. I appreciate it very much. You know, they said for us to, for me to pick a male speaker to have a 10-minute talk who has a year of sobriety. And so just like you said, Jeff said, John. So I called John, and the first words out of John's mouth was, that's me. I'll do it. You know, and he was so ready. And I think he's been eating those words ever since, you know. But he did a fine job, and I'm really happy to have you up here before me. Kind of set the bar for me. My sobriety date is October 28th, 1989. And as Jeff would say, I hope and pray that I always do whatever it takes to maintain that sobriety date. I have a sponsor. She's Carol M., and she lives in West Virginia. And she's going to be moving back to California pretty soon, so I'm grateful for that. I talk to her on the phone at least once a week, and she has a sponsor, Clancy I., that she's had for the last 40 years. She's had one sponsor throughout her whole sobriety. I have a home group, and my home group meeting is a 12 o'clock. I promise I'm sober. It's a 12 o'clock noon meeting, and it meets at 5150 Waring Road. And they have Tuesday closed women's and Wednesday closed mixed gender, and then Friday is open. But they have really long-term sobriety, 30, 40, 50 years. And it's amazing to be a part of something like that and watch these old people come back, you know, week after week and day after day. And just plugging along, it's cool to see people who've known each other, you know, most of their sobriety, and they're sober, you know, several decades. It's a very wonderful thing to be a part of something so big. And Jeff and I have recently moved back here, and we're so grateful for the open arms of Alcoholics Anonymous in this Southern California fellowship. And when I was growing up, I was born in Texas, but we moved here to San Diego when I was about 3. And you know, when I was around 4, and once again, my parents were arguing, and my sister and my mother were, you know, pitted against my father. And I remember thinking, why don't they leave him alone? He just wants a drink. And I knew that when I was 4. And I guess it was the little alcoholic in me that was waiting to happen that identified with the alcoholic that was my father. And I could see the sense of ease and comfort that came with him taking that drink. Didn't know it was a sense of ease and comfort until I came to AA. But I did know that something came over him when he had that drink. I also saw him miss the mark, and I saw him become the belligerent, whacked out dad on the block that everybody, some of the kids feared him, and some of the kids ran from him, and some of the kids, he was, you know, made you laugh. But it was not easy coming home to him, you know. And so I remember thinking, well, I'll never be like him. But I always feel sorry for my dad because he never had a boy. So I was a little tomboy, and, you know, I still don't know what women talk about in the kitchen, y'all. I've never been a woman sitting tracing recipes in the kitchen. I guess that's what they do. I don't know, because I was always out up in the tree when my dad and his buddies were sitting underneath the tree telling dirty jokes. So I know a lot of punchlines, but I can't remember how they began, so. Something about playing in my grass. I don't know. I was too little to know. Then I got older, I didn't want to know. So, and then for my mother, you know, I was, she was just this little West Texas Baptist woman who hooked up with a rip-roaring alcoholic and rode it out for 34 years until alcoholism claimed his life when he was 56 in 1974. And so I was the good girl for her, and I would go to church with her, and I would try to be the good girl for her. I never felt like I fit in my family. I always thought I was adopted. I asked my mom on a regular basis, are you sure I'm not adopted? No, you're not adopted, but it makes so much sense. Why was I in this family that I didn't fit in with? And why was my sister so beautiful and I wasn't? And it just felt like my mother and her were so close. And, you know, I was my dad's favorite, but he was the black sheep and he was always in trouble. So, you know, it was like somehow that didn't count. So then when I was around 12, my mom's God quit working for me. And so now she thinks I'm in the nursery babysitting the kids during church, when really I'm up on the corner smoking cigarettes with the kids. And so my sneaking around phase began. And that was kind of like to be who I was for many years to follow that. My mother had these friends, you know, and all of their friends drank and they played cards and they smoked cigarettes. And, you know, my mother was just this little sweet woman who, you know, wasn't into trouble or anything. She'd bail her friends out of jail because, you know, she was a designated driver before it was cool. And, so, you know, she had this friend named Mary, and Mary had wild red hair and, you know, long cigarettes, and Mary would get drunk and throw things in the bars and get arrested, and I wanted to be like Mary. Mary had a lot of pizzazz, you know, and so I wanted to be like Mary. So, you know, years go by, and I meet my future ex-husband, Mr. Potato Head. And, you know him? So we were on 17 or so. And, you know, the 60s were just coming to a close, and all the stuff was trickling down from San Francisco, and everybody who was around here during that time probably remembers that era. And so my name was to become Charisma, and my friend's name was Willow. And much to my mom's chagrin, you know, we burned our bras and marched in the streets. And so that phase came in, and, you know, in the beginning, my ex-husband's mom, my soon-to-be ex, whoever she was, my first mother-in-law, you know, I'd come from this little place where my mom, you know, she never drank anything, and she would be, you know, freaked out if she thought I was drinking. But this boy, his mother would give me slow gin fizzes. And I remember, this is like soda pop with a kick. I could get used to this. But I also remember thinking, she didn't put enough booze in it, you know. And so that was my second real incident with alcohol. My first one was I was 16, and it was vodka and orange juice, and it went down real smooth, and it came up real smooth until I slithered in the bathtub and passed out, you know. And so I was never to recapture that fond moment of throwing up on vodka, but I still tried, you know. And so I was given little bits here and little bits there, and so pretty soon, you know, I'm drinking martinis with my mother-in-law, and she likes gin, and I like vodka, and, you know, the party's on, and I could go out with her, and we could drink all night, and I was safe with her, and, you know, she'd put one hand over her eye and drive home, you know, and we drink the men under the table every time, and that was kind of like how it was, and it was acceptable, you know, but during somewhere along that timeline, the kind of creepy things started creeping into our house, you know, and our friends were pretty hardcore people, and you know, my spoons are all bent and burnt, and my little crystal goblets from my wedding are all cracked, and you know, and I'm the only one working in the house, and I'd come home from work, and I just knew the Harley Davidson would be hot, and the house would be a mess, and I knew that much, you know, and so it was really hard just being, you know, trying to be married alone, and so pretty soon I just kind of like gave into the whole thing. I thought, well, you know, if you can't beat him, join him. And so that's what I did, and, you know, I did everything I did alcoholically. And so, you know, when I say the party was almost over by that time, but for me it was just getting started, and I didn't know it. I thought it was a party, I thought it was my choice, I thought I was doing all these things because I wanted to, and it wasn't my fault. If you're married to him, you drink too, and I was the eternal victim. And so by this time, I'm starting to have a little side business where I'm an entrepreneur. I frequented Tijuana, and I brought things back with me from Tijuana that I couldn't mass produce, but I could get rid of pretty readily. And I had various ways of bringing things back through that border, but I would always fortify myself with the drink. You know, I had the peppermint schnapps in my purse, or the vodka in my freezer, or, you know, whatever it was, in order for me to go do the deed, you know. And so I would find these slick ways of bringing this product and transport back. And so this one time I had this, there was this thing called 8-track tapes. And you're dating yourself.
Yes, you are.
And so before they got fancy and had glue together, they had screw downs. And so I had this one tape, this Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young screw down 8-track.
and you could unscrew it and cut and splice and take the reel out, and it left a handy little empty compartment, you know, for the transport business. And so you could put your oh, now I have to start over. Oh God, where was I? That's okay. Okay, hi, I'm Anita. So I'm over in Mexico, and I've got this product, and I'm bringing it back. And you know, one more time, I didn't have keys to the trunk, and they're asking me to get in the trunk, and I was like, I don't have keys to the trunk. Didn't even dawn on me that they might want to get in my trunk, because that, you know, that wasn't going to be a problem. I didn't have anything in the trunk. So, but they don't know that. They're thinking, because somebody tipped them off, I guess. I don't know. So the Fitterellis tell me, you know, come on in. So I went inside, and right now I'm, my mom's God had quit working for me, so the only God that I've got at this point in my life is the panic prayer God. Get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. And that was a God of my understanding that I had for many years until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he taught me a new way. And so so I'm praying to this God, get me out of this one, I'll never do it again. I'm just sure I'm on my way to the Mexican penitentiary to, you know, start popping out babies. And the guy comes and he throws my keys and he tells me to get out of Mexico. And I was like, I can leave? And he hits me in the chest with my keys. And I was like, okay. So I'm like getting out of here. And I get in the car and there's the case holder with all the 8-track tapes dumped out, including Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, where they had dumped it overlooking for the product. And so I put them all back in, and I just drove home. And, you know, I was hip, slick, cool. I was anything but grateful. I was lucky, had nothing to do with God, never even looked back, never said thanks, God, never even acknowledged that God had come to my rescue when I prayed, get me out of this one, God, I'll never do it again. And so I was to do it again many, many, many times. And so that was where my life of crime kind of started. I realized that I could make my own money, and I didn't have to have his permission, and I had bigger ones than he did. It gave me power. So pretty soon I got the double-edged sword, you know. Anyway, so then moving forward in my little life, my little story here, by now it's around 19-something, early 70s, and I did the only thing right that I ever did naturally, and that was to have two sons, Jacob in 76 and Jeremy in 78. And you know, I want to say that, you know, I stopped doing all the things that I was doing, and I turned my life around, and I became the upstanding mother that I always swore I would be. Ended up, I became 10 times worse the parent than my father was, the one I always said I'll never be as bad as him. I was, and I passed him and kept on going. He was, my dad was reliable. You know, we always knew he was coming home at 4:30. Even the dog knew she'd go to the window at 4:30 and wait for my dad. You know, he never hit us. He never abused us, you know, other than verbally and kind of embarrassed us on the street. But, you know, he would go down and take care of the neighbors if they caused me trouble. So it was cool. But my kids couldn't say that about me. You know, by the time my kids are 4 and 6, by now, alcoholism has claimed their mother. Alcoholism has disturbed and disrupted their lives. Alcoholism has taken them for a ride that they wouldn't soon forget, and that was the onset of a prelude to many, many years of hard living for my children. Thank God for grandmothers, you know, who could teach them something about, you know, moral fiber and how to be young men and how to have some kind of self-esteem. If self-esteem is learned in the home, they wouldn't have had any had it been up to me because of the way I was living. And still, I thought I was a good mom, you know, because anytime they needed shoes, I'd go steal them. Anytime they needed anything, I'd go steal it. And so by the time their father and I split up, and he kept the boys, you know, my life was such a train wreck. And I was living over in La Mesa, and I remember, you know, we were split up, and he would come and park his motor home in the driveway and, you know, head people off at the pass as they were coming to visit me. And he'd steal my rent money, and then I got evicted. And so really I had no choice but to move back with him, and that's when he took an opportunity to hold on to my sons and put me to the street. Well, I had gone from my father's home to his home. I'd never dealt with anybody like that where my father wouldn't let that stand, so I didn't think that he would. I figured, you know, he'll never keep the boys away from their mom and me away from my sons, but that wasn't to be. He did keep those boys, and he made it very difficult for me to have anything to do with them. And so, but, you know, the sad news is the only time my children knew that their mom was safe is when they'd visit me on the phone through the glass in Las Colinas and or San Diego. And they'd say, "Mom's safe. She's okay. She's in jail." You know, and that's so pathetic to me today, you know. And it's not a source of pride for my fond memories as a mother, believe it. But it's true. It's what happened. So if you're in this room tonight and you've been less than a good parent to your children and maybe you've had to visit them through the facilities or whatever your case is, you know that you're not alone. And we do recover from those types of events in our lives and we can move forward. It doesn't have to be tomorrow just because it was yesterday, you know. And so by now my kids are living with him. And you know, when we split up, the only thing I could do to get over missing those children was to drink and to cry and drink and cry and sleep on your couch. And people get real tired of you drinking and crying and sleeping on their couch, so I started stealing motorhomes. If you have a motorhome, it's instant house, and nobody can kick you out. And unless they come home, the detectives are crawling on it, they can just turn left and go get another one, so that's not a problem. But I liked the big ones with the jacuzzi. I was real picky. There was a few instances, like I can remember before we split, Jeremy was like four. It was just right before we split, like he was four, and my friend and I are going, and we're going to the man's house, and we're driving, and I just as we're pulling up, and I see this van, and it's coming through the bushes, and over here there's a helicopter, and it's flying really low right at us, and I'm like, what? Well, you know what it was. It was a bust, you know, and we're driving right into it. And so those types of things happened to me over and over, and the woman sitting next to me said, you know, there's only reason for one of us to go to jail tonight, and you've got kids. So she took all of it, you know. And so I had things like that happen to me all the time. One time I was getting, I'd gotten, this guy that I was with had ripped off the wrong people. And so when I came out, they snagged me by the hair and handcuffed me to the weight bench down in the basement. Felt like a dungeon. Oh, honey. And they put me to the weight bench, you know, and I knew what was going to happen. You know, there was not a mystery to me because they were very dangerous people. And so, but they had this door that had a little window up on top. And, of course, I was very slender at the time, weren't we all? And as I get through there and I bound down to the sidewalk, he looks up and sees, there she goes. So he's chasing me up the street with a .45 in his hand, you know, and I just get in the middle of the street and I'm going, help, help, help. Well, two ladies come out. They were having an AA meeting in their house. So they came out and they took me, they put me in the back and gave me a bandana for my hair and let me out the back. And those things happened to me over and over. I was at a thrift store in Spring Valley and I terrorized her store. I got mad because I'd made a confession to her. Last time I was here, I got three things and only paid for two. And she said, well, I can never trust you now. I was like, what? I was mortified. You can't trust me now. You know, by now they're calling me Reptilia because I'm leaving stolen cars in people's driveways. But I couldn't understand why she couldn't trust me. And so I was shocked. And so I just, you know, I just terrorized her in her store. And they got helicopters looking for me, you know. So I'm running one more time. And so this lady puts me in her laundry room. And I don't know about you, but when I'm drunk, I don't want to be in no damn laundry room. So I walk out right into a Green and White, which for those of you who don't remember, they used to be a sheriff in Spring Valley. So he took me away one more time for drunk in public. And so over and over and over again, I had these like little mini rescues from the violent crimes or the huge crimes, the large crimes, the felonious crimes that I committed. I would get arrested for things like I'm drunk, I got a $100 bill in my pocket, and I'm drunk in public, but I'm stealing an ice cream out of a 7-Eleven. And I go to jail, and they walk me right past the stolen car in the parking lot that I've got there. You know, so over and over and over and over and over, these things happen all the time. You know, so I mean, when they got me in the back, this one guy and the sheriff, when I walked out to that Green and White, you know, he puts me in the back, takes me away for drunk in public one more time. And I remember I got the handcuff, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm seeing the helicopters just looking for me. I'm thinking, this is the safest place I could be on my way to the drunk tank, you know, one more time. So, yeah, I never got arrested for any of those large crimes, but I sure as hell committed them. You know, I sure as hell did. And so that's when my kids would come and visit me. Is those stupid things. It wasn't my fault. If you're married to him, you drink too. I never knew that if I would put the plug in the jug, I would quit going to jail and visiting my kids on the phone through the glass. It never even occurred to me that alcohol was the problem. Because, you see, alcohol was not a problem for me. Alcohol was a solution. Alcohol made everything seem to make sense to me. It got me off one man and on to the next. It got me off of one chemical and on to the next. Whatever the deal of the day was, alcohol could get me through it. And so it was very acceptable, you know, wherever you could go. You could walk in any bar and you just look around like, who's going to buy my drink? Who's the lucky guy, you know? And, you know, and what about the one coming after that? Because I was a planner. I like to know, you know, what I'm getting next, who's going to get it, when it's going to get here. I was a two-fisted drinker, and it wasn't about water, like I was telling John. So I was always a planner. I never went to bed without wake-up. I always had breakfast waiting for me. And so by now, it's 1989, and I'm standing in front of a judge one more time. I've been all over East County jails and, you know, all over. And so now I'm standing in front of a judge one more time, and he says to me, you know, you've used up all your misdemeanors in my court, which meant he was sick of looking at my face. And he said, but I'd like to send you away for a year for the state, you know, which was prison. And he said to me, but I think you have a problem with alcohol. And I said to myself, problem with alcohol? What's he talking about? It was still falling on deaf ears with me. And he said, but I knew that I had already gotten in trouble when I was out on probation. I committed another crime when I was on probation, and they didn't catch it. And I remember walking out of that court thinking, why am I leaving here? You know what I mean? Like, all those little things happen over and over. So he says, I'd like to send you away for a year, but if you'll go to a recovery home and you'll go the distance, if you'll stay put, I'll accept that in lieu of a year. I felt like the gates of hell slammed shut on me. Oh, my God. The only way I can deal with not having my children in my life is to drink and to cry and to drink and to cry and to steal your motorhome, you know? And he's talking about going to a recovery home with no alcohol and no children. Oh, hell no. And he says, so you'll have to go the distance. You have to stay there. So I had to call this detox every day. Do you have it? Will you have a bed for me? No. Whew. I did not want them to have a bed, believe it. So finally I called one day, and they said, yeah, we'll have a bed for you this Friday. And that would be October 27th of 1989. So I knew by then I had woken up a really old habit just to lose weight, because I was gaining weight the way I was living. And so I thought, I know how to lose weight, heroin. So I woke up a 20-year-old heroin habit to lose weight. So I knew that if I did 3 bags of heroin, it would kill me. So I did 2.5 bags, ate a handful of Valium, washed it down with a bottle of wine, and went to detox. And I was terrified. You know, I didn't think I could live without alcohol. I did not believe it. By now, I'm bringing Short Dogs of Thunderbird in my mom's house, and I'm drinking it on the corner with the boys. I'm saying, if it's good enough to kill my father, it's good enough to kill me. And, you know, my father died when he was 56. And so, you know, I knew it was a killer. And so I didn't have any solutions for living. I didn't know how to live. I felt like I was tossed by the sea, you know, just kind of like by the waves. I don't know how to put it. I just felt like I didn't have a life of my own that I could make decisions for. And so when I went into this, I call this detox. And so I went in there that day, and they verified that I, in fact, was not dead in the back of the van. And then when we got inside there, you know, I started remembering, because once I found out that it was co-ed, I had to repack. And so and so the other half of that little thing was in my short pocket, you know, and I'm saying, until they got, oh, my God, if there's shorts in that suitcase, there's heroin in the pocket. And then I'm brushing my teeth, and out popped out of the dental floss, 2 Valiums and a roach, and I'm turning in all this stuff, you know. And the miracle for me was I didn't regret it. The next day, you know, I remembered it like, wow, if I had that stuff right now, I probably could come down easier than I'm coming down right now, you know, the whole feeling sick and all that. But I didn't regret it. I didn't think, oh God, I wish I had that stuff, I wish I hadn't turned it in. I didn't. And that's a miracle for this alcoholic, because I was a planner. I had one in my hand, I had one ordered, and I'm already looking at where's that next one going to come from. So for me to not have the plan that I needed to find out what was coming next was huge for me. And that was the day of my surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they started taking me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in a 10-day detox. And, you know, they would take me to the detox, to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess I was disruptive, and I probably was. I had a little, you know, jittery problem going on from being awake so much, asleep so much, and now I'm awake. And so they would tell me to go wait in the van. You know, they'd give me their keys and tell me to go wait in the van. I'm looking at these keys and thinking, don't they know I'm a freaking car thief? You know? And so I would put the keys in the front of the van. I would just lay there. I'd go to the back of the van and just rock it out. Then the next couple of times, they let me go to meetings and stay the whole time. And I started seeing the love in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started seeing women reaching out to me. And they weren't looking at me like I was something scary that they had to protect themselves and their children from. They looked at me like they had love in their eyes. And I'll never forget that. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a sense of purpose for the first time in a very, very, very long time. They welcomed me back. We were the women in the van. I was the only one with a current, accurate driver's license. So I had to do all the driving, which I was used to, driving. And so I would take people to meeting, women to meetings, three times a day for about 4 months. And I got tons of AA meetings under my belt in the first 90 days, 100 days. And I started hearing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of recovery. And I would hear people talk about, like I heard somebody take a 4-year cake one time. I thought, no way, 4 years? I don't get that, you know. I'd been dry a couple years here and there. 2 years was about nothing to me. But 4 years, that was like, so that was my, you know, my quest, you know, 4 years. And so then, like, you know, 10 days later, you know, I'm in this recovery home and they're teaching me how to do the steps. So step one, you know, where you admit you're powerless over alcohol and that your life is becoming manageable. And I didn't understand quite what that meant. You know, I couldn't do it off the wall, and the book did not make any sense to me. And so they had me do instances of personal powerlessness over alcohol at times of unmanageability and loss of control as I identified with Bill's story. His story is laced with it. You know, and you can look and say, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Did I do what he did? And so I pinpointed his times of personal powerlessness that I could see in his story, loss of control and unmanageability as it related to me, and then I wrote my little story. For step two, you know, come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. First of all, I believed in God, but I didn't believe God believed in me. My mom's God quit working a long time ago, and I just got here with the panic prayer of God, so I didn't see a whole lot of God in my future. And being restored to sanity wasn't insane. If you're married to him, you drink too, and I was the victim, so what are you going to do with that, you know? And so what they told me, they started explaining to me that there's different kinds of insanity. You know, one is the same thing, expecting different results. The other one is the insanity of picking up the first drink when you know what the last drink does to you and how it sets up the motion, the progression. And the other thing is the insane lifestyle. You know, how was I living? You know, most people, the PTA moms don't visit their kids on the phone through the glass. You know, if they do it once, they damn sure don't do it twice, you know, and they don't make a life history of it. So those things I started seeing, you know, it was just with an open mind, really. I was just willing. And I remember when I told the lady, you know, that I lost my children to drugs and alcohol. She said, no, you didn't lose them. You traded them. Whoa. I felt like she slapped my face. You know, the first instinct was to tear her hair out. But the... You know, because it cut so deep, but it had such a ring of truth to it, you know, that I had put those children in those positions of jeopardy, you know, many, many times. I've got my kids in the back of the car driving to school with guys whose motto is, this car will not stop for the law. They'll have a shootout before they'll pull over. And I've got my kid in the back going to preschool, you know. That's the kind of mom I was, and those are the kind of people that I ran with, but that was by choice. And I wanted my kids to, you know, toughen up, you know. It'll be all right, you know. And so then for step three, So the first two steps are reflection steps. The first real action step is step three. So this is my opportunity to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of the God of my understanding. Now, I had to do an overhaul there of the God of my understanding. My mom's God had quit working for me for some reasons. The whole punishing God thing wasn't working for me. It didn't work when I was 8. Sure didn't work when I was 12, and it's not going to work when I'm 38. So that had to have an overhaul. There was a few things. And so I understood then that I didn't have to have any set religion in order to have a God of my understanding. I didn't have to go to a place of prayer, even though I could if I wanted to. And it was a good thing to do if that's what I wanted to do. But I didn't have to do it in order to fit in here, in order to have a chair next to you, you know. And I understand, too, that it's kind of hard to turn the little blue-haired lady on the pew next to me in church and tell her, I really want a drink today, you know. Her eyes will roll back and she'll scoot to the left, you know. So I understand that, you know, I can talk to you guys from the heart, you know, heart to heart, and you understand me. We have the point of identification. And so my step four, where we make a moral inventory, you know, I had a lot of problems with that because I didn't know how to do it, and it was just one more thing I felt very dumb and stupid about.
And so I had this sponsor,
wonderful as she was, who fired me because she thought I was unwilling to do this four step.
The truth was, I didn't know how. So instead of taking me by the hand or sitting me down and saying, "Open your book, we're gonna do this together," she said, "I think you need to find another sponsor." You know, she calls me up one day. She goes, "How are you doing, Anita?" And I said, "I'm doing well. I'm great." She was like, "I kind of find it hard to believe." I was like, "Well,
sorry, I don't have any catastrophe to report, but you know, I've seen my kids on a regular basis. I got a little part-time job. I'm going to tons of meetings. Nobody's hitting me today. You know, I'm not going to jail. Life is sweet for me. Life was really sweet." And she said, "Well, I think you need to find another sponsor." I was like freaked out. So I said, "Oh my God, I know I can't be without a sponsor." So the first meeting I go to, the first woman I see being of service in that meeting, I'm going to ask her to be my sponsor. And I walked in, and there was a lady at the back, and she was at the literature table. And I asked her, "Do you have a working knowledge of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Will you show me how to do 4 and 5? She said, "Sure." So she told me, "Just write down the names of people that you have a grudge against for whatever reason. Don't worry about it. You know, we'll do that together." And then so that's all I did, you know, and I eked out this little fourth. And she told me and showed me how to do, look at, you know, how it affected me and what was my part in it, you know, or what was my, where was I to blame. She also took me through a sexual harms inventory, where was I selfish, dishonest, and considered afraid, who did I hurt, did I arouse jealousy in someone, oh, heck yeah, didn't everybody, you know, I was like, wasn't that part of the game? And then I had a fears list, you know, and, you know, we list our fears and why we have them. It's because self-reliance has failed them. So where have I taken God out of the picture on this? And so, you know, I made a commitment to the women coming in behind me that, that wouldn't happen to them, you know? And so when we take a third step prayer, I give them about 10 minutes to bask in the glory of that third step prayer. Then we get busy. And I take her through the example of the written inventory, you know, so she knows her major, resentment, the cause, effect, her part, sexual harms inventory, and fears inventory. So then I tell her, go home now and revisit step three and enjoy step three tonight or over the weekend or whatever. And then on Monday morning, you've got a clear picture in your own handwriting of what step four needs to look like for you. And we sit down, and so that's been working really, really well when they go home and actually participate in that. Some of them do, some don't. Then you got the question, are you working it or sitting on it, you know? And they're pretty honest. I'm sitting on it, you know. So then I ramp them up, back up, visit three, roll into four. And so for step five, I did it with her. And then for step six and seven, you know, I got to go to a place called Wells Park over in El Cajon. And I'm sitting there on this blanket, and I'm sitting on grace, and I know it. And it's in the sunny side of the street, man. I've got women onto my left who are moms with kids and strollers and kites even, you know. And then and that's my future. And I got people over here, the burnout, dope fiend, drug addicts, which is where I just came from. And that's my immediate past. And I'm right in the middle sitting on grace. And I'm asking God to help me, to show me my defects of character. And I'm asking him, humbly asking him to remove those. If they're in the way of my usefulness to you, God, take them away. Take them away. So God's like at a thrift store, right? Or he's at a garage sale. He's walking through and saying, I'll take this one, and this one. See ya. Wait. I wanted you to take this. Well, that's not really in the way, and you can use it to help others. Ugh. So you know, that's been my journey. And then so for, you know, for step eight, I was taught, don't let the fear of step nine keep you from getting willing and honest for your step eight, to get real and to get thorough on your step eight. That's where the division comes sometimes. I sponsored a lady. We went all the way through, and she got drunk on her eighth step. And right now I have no idea where she is. But I do know that the fear of nine, fear of making those amends. And I'll tell you, if you're struggling with any of the steps, refocus on your faith and your higher power. Like, you don't have to do this alone. It's not about, you know, my will with God's power. It's about God giving me the power to do his will. And so you just need to make sure that you're clear on that. And if you're not, back up, revisit the last step and see where you got side railed. That was my suggestion. And so for step eight, I had a healthy amends list. And for step nine, you know, for one thing, I have some living amends. You know, Rainey taught me, some of you probably remember Rainey from the East County. She was my spiritual advisor and my H&I sponsor, and she got me busy in service right away. And I was doing H&I. I've been doing H&I for, I don't know, 12, 15 years, off and on, depending on where we're living. And it's been the cornerstone of my sobriety for as long as I'm doing it. And Rainey taught me so much. You know, she taught me, don't go make amends that you have to make amends for. We don't want, I want to send you back. And don't make amends that you haven't discussed with me. You have no right to put your children through any more of the horrible things you've made them go through before, and your mother too, you know. And so, you know, she said you can't ease your conscience at their expense. You know, and sometimes as bad as I want to come clean with something, you know, I have to think about the babies. I have to think about my mother. I had to think about the people who would go to jail with me, you know, and some of those things I really wanted to clear out. I got oh so willing in step eight that sometimes it's hard to look at step nine and say, I can't do that one, you know. But left to my devices, I would just do it and get the jig was up. But Rainey taught me not to. She said, just don't do anything alone. So, you know, that was humility for me, was thinking, you know, okay, maybe she knows better. You know, because at first I'm thinking, okay, she doesn't really know what she's talking about. How can she tell me not to make that, you know? But the book is real clear. We don't want to harm others in our progress. And so some of those I just have to sit with, and that just is my path. And then for step 10, you know, we continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. And having done the personal inventory in four, like right now, I know how to do it because I just come from there. And so it's kind of like getting the dust bunnies out from underneath the bed. You know, we wash the dishes in the sink all the time, but what about the dust bunnies? They're starting to collect, you know. So every now and then you want to get and do something a little bit deeper, you know. I didn't realize that I was running on fear. I was maybe 15 years sober. I had no idea. I had five fears in my life that were dominating my life. I'm calling the mayor of the town that I worked for to get the desired results, you know, instead of talking to God about it. So, I mean, I got wrapped around the hood big time on that one. And so I have to, like, go back and review and see, where did I get off track? You know, it's so easy to get off track. The third step is taking me out of the center and switching places with God. So now I've got God in the center of my universe, and I'm just one more of the things that are circling around the nucleus of my existence, which is my creator. And I know when I get off balance. I know when I'm in the middle and I stick God over here. Like, I got this one, right? And so it's just like getting back on track, like, okay, God, help me get back God-centered instead of self-centered. Because if self is the problem, guess what? Out of self is the solution. And so for step 11, it hinges with step 10, where we keep our side of the street clean. And then we have prayer and meditation, which is the bridge between 10 and 12. And so I don't just give you as Anita sees it. I actually can give you some recovery and something to pass on straight out of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12 and 12. And so for step 12, you know, carrying the message and having the spiritual awakening, I got busy because I wanted the ninth step promises and I wanted the 12-step awakening, spiritual awakening. And those are selfish reasons to do the right thing. You know, right thing, wrong reason. Whatever, it worked. You know, it's just like coming here for your kids and staying for you. Whatever gets you here, whatever gets you motivated. You can always change your motivations as you go. And so, and then about 1996, the last 4 years of my mom's life, I got to take care of her. And I got to be the daughter she always deserved, and we got to have the relationship I always wanted, and I got to help her exit this planet with dignity. And she was forever grateful for her daughter's sobriety and for Alcoholics Anonymous. She would go to any lengths to help me stay sober, and she you know, she gave her undying love to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she thanked you for her sober daughter. And my sons, thank you for their sober mother. One of those kids that I dragged through my story has 8.5 years sober in AA now. And you know, he got married, and he's got a couple of kids that came with her, and they're happy, you know, and he's a strong AA man. And then I married Jeff in 1998 up north, and we were up there for about just under 14 years. And, you know, we were busy up there, you know. I got the job as the executive assistant to the chief of police for a town in the Bay Area. And he knew all about my history. He knew all about my past. In fact, when the guy that hired me, when the city manager said, I'm going to move you over to the police department, he's going to be your direct report, and he starts talking about FBI and fingerprints and DOJ, and I just kicked his door shut and said, we need to talk. Yeah, oh, my God. Talk about fear, you know. And then when they did the background on me, all they did was a financial background. They didn't even do a criminal background. Talk about God. Well, so this guy tells me, I tell him, yeah, he's talking about getting badged. And so he says, wait a minute. Don't you go down to San Mateo every few weeks and you take the AA into those people down there? And I said, yeah. He goes, don't you have to be badged to do that? And I said, yeah. He goes, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. So my H&I work got me in the job, you know. And so finally I got a chief that I could really open up and talk to. And this guy is so awesome. And I asked him, I said, you know, because I wanted him to know who he's doing business with, you know. So I said, have you ever looked at my file? You know, he and I were the only ones who had keys to it, you know. He's the new chief, you know. And he goes, no, I'll get to it someday. One day he walks up and he just plops it on my desk. He goes, you were busy. And I was so embarrassed. And I said, see why I don't drink anymore? And I asked him, I said, I have a question, though. It's always bugged me all these years. That one right there where it says taking a car without permission, I didn't know the people. How can it be taking a car without permission? Whatever happened to Grand Theft Auto? And he said, it's just a nicer way of saying the same thing, but you don't get a felony for it. And if I would have done that, if I would have gotten the felony for it, I couldn't have been his. I couldn't have done any of the things that God's got me doing today, you know, or had me doing then, you know. So I got to retire from that town. I was their city clerk. I was really close with the city council. And, I mean, God put me to work busy, you know. I sponsored tons of women up there. And Jeff and I would speak all the way from Monterey to Sacramento to all points north and south. And, you know, we were busy at conferences. And we just had a beautiful, wonderful life in San Francisco Bay. It's gorgeous up there. Look cold, you know. So at the end of 08, Jeff says, you know, I'd like to go back to California, up to San Diego, and take care of you. And, hey, I'm okay for that, you know. But I was making really good money, and he was making excellent money. And but, you know, it seemed like God's plan. I had God's hand all over it. So I retired, and we moved down here. And then a few months later, he retired. And that was in February of 09. And then about a week and a half later, my husband suffered from a stroke. And it took out his left peripheral, both eyes. And I always knew that I was married to the best man I know. And I always knew he had strong character and that he had strength of... John, you set me up for this. just to be able to watch the dignity and grace that you walked through all this with and the strength of character. And he still is concerned about my feelings. And how am I doing? And you know, and I mean, I just look at you in awe all the time. I'm so proud to be your wife. I'm so grateful to have you. So he started. Well, about 3 months after that, we went on a trip to Utah, and he's sitting facing me, and I look over his shoulder, and there's, you know, jump Moab, right? That means skydive, Moab, and I'm like, we should do that. And he turns and looks and goes, do that? Why would we do that? I said, why wouldn't we do that? You know? And the next day or two, we're jumping out of a plane 10,000 feet over the canyons of Moab, Utah. And it's so beautiful. And now there's no ladder too high for him, you know? And he can change any light bulb I can come up with. And so then before you know it, he's up restuccoing the whole house. And Travis comes over, and Travis put himself to work and being of service to our house like he was my own son, like he was our own son. And thanks, Steve, for sharing your son with us at the level you have. Travis, we couldn't replace you in a million years. We love you so much. And, you know, my boys are up north, you know, so, and I love having sons, you know. And so Travis has filled a huge void in the life where I miss my son so much. And I appreciate that, Travis. He's always so kind to us. But he came over and he was just of service, you know. And sometimes Jeff's easy to be along with, and sometimes Jeff can be a grump, you know. And Travis just took it all in stride, just like if he was a son, you know. And in fact, he treated him better than my sons at some point, you know. But so, you know, and Jeff taught my sons how to respect Alcoholics Anonymous and how to respect his position as their stepdad. And my ex-husband, Mr. Potato Head, called him up and thanked him for everything he'd done for his sons over the years, you know. I mean, he's very grateful to Jeff. Jeff's been a wonderful influence on the boys. And so then we came back down here, and now we're active again. And it took about a year for me to get active. Jeff had his stroke and then got active with the guys right away. And then my job was just like to get Jeff here and there, you know. So then God put these wonderful, beautiful women in my life. And I get Heather and Cheryl, and I get to see Mimi, and just the beautiful, wonderful, and Cindy, the wonderful, beautiful women. You know, I didn't trust women when I got here. I thought y'all had, you know, long toenails, and you'd crawl on your belly, and you wanted my man or whatever I had, you know. And then Rainey and the other women taught me, you know, the men will pat your ass, but the women will save it. And so I believed that. I started believing in things that women would tell me, you know, and they've guided me over the years. And, you know, they tell me that they care more about my life than they do about my feelings, and they don't mind hurting my feelings if it means saving my life. So I love that. I love strong sponsorship. I love people who are in love, activists,
with Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that saved my life, the thing that gave me a life. So I am grateful. I am a grateful alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for the God that I found here. Thank you.